Odyssey. So I'm going to start with a little historical introduction. So what are the ideas that are at the basis of Thorsted's cryptography? And then we'll discuss the primitive subgroup of the finite field, which is the subgroup where Thorsted's cryptography takes place. And we'll discuss the representation of the elements of this subgroup and how the arithmetic can be performed in there. And then, of course, the discrete logarithm problem, how hard it is, and how it relates to the discrete logarithm problem in the finite field where the primitive subgroup is contained. And we'll have some closing remarks and open questions. So I'm trying to stress, I'm trying to give a comprehensive introduction, but also to stress what are the open questions in this. So the idea of Thorsted's cryptography, I think, can trace me back to two systems. One of them is Look. Look works in the subgroup of elements of FQ squared, whose order is a divisor of Q plus 1. So here Q is a prime or a prime power, doesn't matter. And the idea is that you can represent an element of this subgroup via its trace. So you're working in a finite field that has Q squared elements, but this subgroup can be represented via an element that is in FQ. And the same idea appears in XTR. XTR is an acronym for Efficient and Compact Subgroup Trace Representation. XTR works with the subgroup of a field with Q to the sixth elements. And the elements that we consider are those whose order is a divisor of Q squared minus Q plus 1. And these elements can be represented via their trace. So the trace is an element of FQ squared instead of FQ to the sixth. So what we need to do if we want to do, for example, Diffie-Hellman key exchange, and we want to work with the representations of the elements, we need to have the trace. We have the trace of an element to some power A, so the trace of alpha to the A, and we have an exponent B, and we want to compute the trace of alpha to the AB. And this can be done efficiently by using recurrent sequences. So this is also where Look takes its name, because Look uses Lucas recurrent sequences to compute the trace of alpha to the AB from the trace of alpha to the A and B. So the main selling point of these systems is that the complexity of the discrete logarithm problem in the subgroup is the same as the complexity of the discrete logarithm problem in the surrounding field. We'll get back to this later. And so while the complexity of the discrete logarithm problem stays unchanged, the representation of the element is more compact. So in the Look subgroup, we can represent an element via only one FQ coordinate, as opposed to two coordinates that we would need to represent a generic element of FQ squared star. And in the XTR subgroup, we can represent an element via two FQ coordinates instead of six that we would normally need. So one can observe that the representations are not one-to-one. Let me go back for a second. For example, in Look, you see that the trace of alpha is the same as the trace of alpha to the Q. So you identify some elements, but this doesn't really matter. And the arithmetic is efficient because it's done via recurrence relations. So same difficulty of the discrete logarithm problem and more compact representation of the elements are the two main points. And these are the idea that Thorsted-based cryptography takes from these systems. So the idea is we're going to work in the primitive subgroup of a finite field with Q to the N elements. I'll be more specific about what this is in a second. We're going to have the same complexity that if we're working the whole finite field for the DLP. But we're going to have, or at least we hope to be able to have, a more compact representation for the element. So we're only going to use phi of n coordinates instead of n, where phi of n here is the Euler phi function. And the means we're going to try to use to do this are some arithmetic and geometric constructions. So this is, in summary, what we're going to discuss. And here's what the primitive subgroup is. So we're going to take the subgroup of elements of F2 to the n star, whose order is a divisor of the n cyclotomic polynomial evaluated at Q. So the second cyclotomic polynomial was Q plus 1, and the sixth cyclotomic polynomial is Q squared minus Q plus 1. So this is what was being done in LOOC and in XDR. And we want to consider the DLP both in the field and in this group. So some things that we can observe right away are that, well, of course, this is a subgroup, and it has phi n of q elements, because we're solving the equation g to the phi of n of q equal to 1. So these elements, this is about q to the phi of n of, this is about here. Okay, I'll do without. This is about q to the phi of n, where the phi of n is the Euler function, because that's the degree of the n cyclotomic polynomial. And in the finite field, we have q to the n elements, about. I mean, in the multiplicative group. And what's important to notice is that in almost every case, the smallest field that contains this primitive subgroup is exactly fq to the n star. And this is important because otherwise we could just reduce and work in a subfield, in a proper subfield that contains the group. And again, the complexity is going to turn out, I'm going to discuss the DLP in the end, and so we'll say more about this later, but it's going to turn out that the complexity of solving the discrete logarithm problem in the primitive subgroup and in the finite field is the same. So the idea is that it would be practical to work in this subgroup if we can represent the elements via phi of n coordinates in Fq, as opposed to the n coordinates that we would need for a general element of Fn, Fq to the n star. So this is the goal, what we want to do. We want to find a way to represent the elements in the primitive subgroup via phi of n coordinates in Fq, as it's done in LOOC and XDR. So what are the cases that are most interesting for us? So in other words, for which n do we have the best gain? And observe that if we represent an element in the primitive subgroup, as we're hoping to do, so with phi of n coordinates, we have a gain of phi of n over n in the size of the representation. So no, this is, I mean, the size of the representation is phi of n over n times as big as the size of the representation is fq to the n star. So we want to minimize phi of n over n. And this ratio only depends on the prime factors that appear in the number n and not on their multiplicity. Therefore, to keep n small, it's preferable to take n to be a square-free number. And this phi is a multiplicative function, so we might as well look at the factors. And phi of p over p is increasing as a function of p. So phi of p over p is p minus 1 over p. So this is increasing as a function of p. So we're better off if we pick the product of the first few primes. And so the most interesting cases are n equal 2, 6, 30, 210, and then 210 is already big, so I guess one should stop there. Okay? At least for the practical application. I mean, the question maybe of how to represent this could be interesting in general, but for the practical application, this would be the interesting cases. So, what's the idea of how we're going to represent these elements? We're going to construct a variety, which will be defined over Fq in such a way that when we take Fq Hessian points, we recover our subgroup. And so we start from a group that is an algebraic object, and we associate a geometric object. And then we're able to use a geometric or arithmetic approach to work on that, hopefully. And that's what we're going to try to do. in order to do that, I want to give a different description of the primitive subgroup. So I thought, I'm sure everyone knows what the norm map is, but since it's going to come up a lot, I thought I'll repeat that. So if we have a field extension, FQ to the L, subfield of FQ to the N, the norm map relative to the extension sends an element alpha to the product of its conjugate. So the formula is up there. This is a group homomorphism between FQ to the N star and FQ to the L star. And what was observed in a 2003 paper by Rubin and Silverberg is that the primitive subgroup is the intersection of the kernels of all the norm maps that are relative to the proper subfields of FQ to the N star, which is the elements of the primitive subgroup are exactly the elements of FQ to the N star whose norm is equal to 1 for every proper subfield. For example, the case n equals 6 is the one that we're going to concentrate the most on because it's the biggest case that's been done. If we consider elements of FQ to the 6th star, the primitive subgroup, we had defined it to be the element whose order was the divisor of Q squared minus Q plus 1. And another way that we can see this is that the kernel of this map, so I'm putting the subfields of FQ to the 6th, which are proper subfields, are FQ, FQ squared, FQ to the 3rd. And so we have three norm maps. And I'm writing them compactly as only one map and take the kernel of that. So our element alpha maps to the norm FQ to the 6th, relative to the inclusion FQ to the 6th in FQ, FQ in FQ to the 6th, and then the extension FQ squared in FQ to the 6th, FQ to the 3rd in FQ to the 6th. So that's the map. And the primitive subgroup is exactly the set of all the elements whose image is 1, 1, 1. So the kernel of this map. And observe that, maybe it's not so clear just staring at it, but Q squared minus Q plus 1 is the GCD of the three exponents there in the norm maps. And this is exactly what happens in the general case, and this is exactly why this subgroup is the intersection of the kernels. So this gives us a way to define a variety. So we're going to take, we need to make a field into a variety first. So we want to, the first ingredient that we need is a variety whose f rational points over every field are just the multiplicative group of the field, and that's the multiplicative group Gn. And now we're going to take the various fictional scalars from some field, let's say fq to the L to fq of the multiplicative group. And this is because I don't want to give the definition of various fictional scalars, but the property of the various fictional scalars that we need here is that when we take FQ rational points of the various fictional scalars from FQ to the L to FQ, these are exactly the FQ to the L rational points of whatever we have here. So this is the defining property of the various fictional scalars, and this is exactly the way that we construct varieties on the two sides, such that here if we take FQ rational points, we get FQ to the L star for each L divisor of N. So you see, if you take this map and you take FQ rational points, we get, on the left-hand side, we get FQ to the N star, and on the right-hand side, we get the direct sum of FQ to the L star, where L is a divisor of N. And the maps in the middle are the norm maps. So now the norm maps, you can lift them to the various fictional scalars, and when you take FQ rational points, you get the norm map again. And so this gives you a way, so that observation there that the primitive subgroup is an intersection of kernels gives you a canonical way to construct a variety whose FQ rational points will be your primitive subgroup. And it's exactly this. So the FQ rational points of this variety are our group. So I guess what I'm trying to stress is that this is a very natural way to construct this variety, but apart from the construction, the important point is that we can take a group and in some way construct a variety so that when we take FQ rational points, we recover our group. And now we're going to try to exploit the geometry of the variety. So, oh, I forgot to say this variety Tn is called a torus because it's an algebraic torus, which means that over some extension it splits as a product of multiplicative groups. And there's a conjecture in arithmetic geometry that says that these varieties are all rational. So the goal here will be to show in an efficient way, in an explicit way, that these maps, that these varieties are rational. So the goal will be to construct two maps in the two directions between the variety and an affine space, which are maybe not defined on all points, but on almost all points, so that when we take FQ rational points, we have on the left-hand side our group, and on the right-hand side we have phi of n copies of FQ. So then these two maps will give us a way to associate to every element of the group a vector with phi of n coordinates in FQ. So this is the goal. And we believe that this is true because, because arithmetic geometers believe that it's true, no one has been able to disprove this. And you expect, at least in the easy cases, this should be true. This is my laptop, not that one. And in fact, this conjecture has been proved in some cases. So it's been proved for the case when n has at most two distinct prime divisors. For the cases of interest for us, this will be when n is a prime or a product of two distinct primes. And moreover, it's been proven that you can find such maps if you add some extra copies of a fine space or of FQ on both sides. So this is called being stably birational. So on one side, we hope that we can find those maps for every n. And on the other side, we know for a fact that we're going to be able to find them, even though this proof is non-constructive. So this doesn't give you a way to come up with a map. And it doesn't even tell you how big K should be. So you have a guarantee that you're going to be able to find something there, but you have no guarantee that it will be practical. But at least we know that we're looking for something that should be there. And so the natural questions are, can we write down this map? So can we write down these explicit maps in the two directions for the cases that were of interest to us? So for 2, 6, 30, and 210. And the answer is yes for 2 and 6, which were the cases of Luke and XPR. And this has been done in a slightly different manner by Rubin and Silverberg in this paper in 2003, where they find maps which are actually 1-to-1. I'm going to discuss this in a second. And the first open case is n equal to 30. So this is not done. The second question is, can we hope to add maybe the second best thing to do if we cannot write down this map would be to add a few copies of FQ on each side and find the two maps. And this gives you asymptotically an optimal representation. But of course it's not as good, right? But if we can find it for a small value of k, it will still be pretty good. And this has been done for n equal to 30 with k equal to 2, and for n equal to 110 for k equal to 22. And of course we hope that we think that you should be able to do it for k equal to 0. So there should be some space for improvement there, especially in the 210-22. This 22 is very big. So there should be some space for improvement there. Right. And so that's the question that I put down there. Can we find some maps of this form for n equal 30 and 210 with a small value of k? So these are like the big open questions in this area. If you want the more theoretical open questions, And now I'd like to say a few words on how this is done for the SQ to the sixth. So we have a subgroup of SQ to the sixth, and in order to represent SQ to the sixth, we're gonna choose an element that generates SQ squared over SQ. And then we're gonna choose an SQ base of SQ to the third. So we end up with an SQ base of SQ to the sixth. And now, the T6 of SQ, so this subgroup that we're working, that we want to represent here, is always going to be included in the two-dimensional torus, in the SQ to the third rational points of the two-dimensional torus. And this is because this subgroup here, this primitive subgroup SQ to the sixth, in SQ to the sixth, is given by two norm conditions. And the two-dimensional torus is given by one of those two norm conditions. You can just write it down. So the first step that we can do to represent this is to embed the two-dimensional torus, SQ to the third rational point, into SQ to the sixth star. And this will give us something which is bigger than what we want, but will be, that's our step one. So we take SQ to the third, we just write our elements in a basis, and so we map them into SQ to the sixth in a basis, and then we do plus this x that generated SQ squared over SQ, and SQ to the third in the bottom. And by doing it in this way, we're guaranteed that the norm relative to the extension SQ to the third in SQ to the sixth is 1. And this is just because of the way we construct that. When you take the Q to the third power of that, you're just inverting numerator and denominator. And in this way, we've embedded G2 Q to the third in FQ to the sixth star. This is what we've done so far. And now we want to get rid of the points that we have that are extra and we don't need. So how are we going to do that? We're going to impose this extra condition that we haven't used yet, that the norm relative to the extension FQ squared in FQ to the sixth is also 1. So first, we observe that even though we don't know yet what these points are going to look like, but if we restrict to those points, that's going to give us everything. And this is Hilbert's theorem 90. If you don't know what Hilbert's theorem 90 is, the statement is exactly the rewriting of what we want to do. It exactly tells you each element in SQ to the sixth star can be written in this form, which is exactly the surjectivity of the map. So this is going to be enough for what we need to do. It's going to be enough to take this U subset of elements that have the SQ to the 2, including SQ to the 6 norm equal to 1, and that's going to be all that we need to do. That's going to be our representation. And if you write out the condition given by the norm, just by multiplying the elements, we get a degree 2 equation. So this U, we can think of as a surface in a three-dimensional space. And this surface is given by a quadratic equation. So it's an especially easy case, because now we can take a point from the surface and project. So we have a surface and we have a plane under, and we just project down. And since the surface is quadratic, everything's going to work very nicely. We get a one-to-one map almost everywhere. And so we get these bijections from F Q squared minus a small set to our surface minus a point to our group. So this is the map that we want in the end. I want to point out that even though it may look like this procedure gives you a way to parameterize a torus for an extension, not only 6, but 2p, where p is a prime, this is not exactly true, because when you go and ahead and write down your surface, you get a higher degree equation, and then your map is not going to be one-to-one anymore. So this doesn't extend, at least in a straightforward manner, to a parametrization for a 2p torus. Of course, you can get a parametrization that is p minus 1 to 1. P minus 2 to 1. for a certain prime p. So how does this map look like if we pick a basis and write it out? This example also comes from the paper of Rubin and Silverberg. It's the example that everybody always shows, and it's the example on which all the computations are done. So since I have some timings afterwards on the efficiency of the group operation, on how much it requires to compute the group operation, I thought I'd present this one. So if our Q is to a 5 modulo 9, we can take a primitive third root of unity to generate our degree 2 extension, and then we can take the sum of a primitive ninth root of unity with its inverse to generate the cubic extension, and we can write down our map like that, where the set S is the set where the map is not defined. So the set that we lose when we do this projection operation. And so the difficult map to write is this one. The inversion is easier. So that's why I'm always talking about this map. This is the hard one to do. Once you have this, then you can just invert it, and that's easier. So the map in the other direction, you can write an element in the basis 1x, where these two things now are going to be in sq to the third, and then you can write them out in the basis and get the inversion. So anyway, this is just to show an example of how a specific map looks like. And if we want to do arithmetic now, we have a few choices to do that. So we have a bijection between a group and sq squared. I'm forgetting about the few points where it's not defined. So we have a bijection between a group and a set. So we can use the bijection to transport the group operation to the set, of course. But if we do that, you can optimize a little bit, and the figures you get are that these are how many operations in SQ you need to compute a multiplication in the square. So you always need to do one inversion, and then you have, for example, for a multiplication, you have 24 multiplications, 43 additions in SQ, and one inversion. So it looks like the most efficient thing to do is to use the bijection only to represent the elements, but perform the operation in sq to the sixth. And if you regard your sq to the sixth as a degree 6 extension of sq, these are the figures that are in this. There's a paper of Granger, Page, and Stam where they compare the efficiency of this 6 representation for the 6 torus and XTR. And these are the figures are from this paper. So if we regard sq to the sixth as a degree 6 extension of sq, we get for a multiplication, for example, 18 multiplication in sq and 53 additions. And if we do the extension in two steps, so first a quadratic extension, then a cubic, first a cubic extension, then a quadratic, we get slightly worse, but these are comparable. And these figures are only for this representation here that I presented. So there's a lot of choices that we've been doing here. So one question that I see that I think is important is how, I mean, there's a lot of different representation even in the papers of Rubin and Silverberg for this story, and which ones are the best ones? Or can we find different maps? Now that we understand how to produce this map, can we find different ones that work better with the group operation so we can do this more efficiently? So that was the best that was done for a representation which is optimal, so that uses Q to the C of N elements for the subgroup, the primitive subgroup of sq to the n star. And the first case for which this has not been done, we said, was the primitive subgroup of sq to the 30 star. And for this, some work has been done. So the first result was from Van Dijk and Woodruff in 2004. They were able to construct a bijection which missed a few points, as usual, on both sides, between the primitive subgroup of sq to the 30 and 32 copies of sq with 40 copies of SQ. So you see what we would like. So the 30th cyclotomic polynomial has degree 8. So what we would want would be this with SQ to the 8. Now, they add 32 on both sides, and they say, well, asymptotically, this is optimal, which is true. But we're going to see in a second that we can do better. But the main idea of how to do it is already contained in their work. And their idea is this. They take the 30th cyclotomic polynomial, and they find a polynomial identity that involves it. And now, this polynomial identity has other factors. In this case, they're all simple factors, powers of x minus 1. And now they add, on the left and on the right, groups that correspond to these factors. And the equation tells them where to map what. It's a sort of a Chinese remaindering. Right? So an equation like this tells you, you look for the factors of this here, and that tells you where to map the elements of that order. So it relates the orders of the domain and of the codomain for you. So this is the main idea behind how they construct that map. It's really an effective version of Chinese remainder theorem. And using the same exact idea, the next year, in all these people, Van Dijk, Granger, Page, Rubin, Silverberg, Stamm, and Woodruff, come up with better equations and therefore with better representations. So they use, for example, for the torus in SQ to the 30, they use that equation there, that the 30th cyclotomic polynomial times the 6th cyclotomic polynomial is the same as the 6th cyclotomic polynomial evaluated in x to the 5th. So this tells them, when you use that to map the order of the elements, this contribution is the part that corresponds to the 30th cyclotomic polynomial. This contribution here is what corresponds to the 6th cyclotomic polynomial. And this part, G6SQ to the 6th, Q to the 5th is what corresponds to the 6th cyclotomic polynomial. So this would be the element in FQ to the 30 whose such that alpha to the Q to the 10 minus Q to the 5th plus 1 is equal to 1. Okay, so this is the FQ to the 6th, FQ to the 5th rational point of the 6th torus. So using that equation, they write this map. And now you observe that since you have 6 tori on the left and on the right, you know how to represent those in an optimal way. And you compose with those maps. And in the end of the day, you can replace this with an FQ squared. You can replace this with an FQ to the 5th squared. So that's an FQ to the 10. And it gives you this map. And the same you can do for 210. Just with more factors. This also shows sort of implicitly how this torus embeds in that. That's what I was saying before, that when we wanted to represent our aspirational points of our 6 torus, we were going to first think of SQ to the 3rd rational points of the 2 torus. And this shows you how the SQ rational points of the 30 torus are contained in the SQ to the 5th rational points of the 6th torus. This is always the case when you have factorization. It's just a property of the norm map. So this is the best that has been done for 30. And this is the best that has been done for 210. And now it's clear that if you can find better equations, so better equation, I mean lower degrees equation, that involves your cyclotomic polynomials, and you combine that with an effective version of Chinese remainder theorem, you're going to find a better parametrization for this. So this is one avenue. Of course, it's not the only avenue. If you think of it arithmetically, this is not the way you'd think to go about it, I think. But this is a way, and it's worked better than all the other approaches so far. Okay. So now, for discrete logarithm problem. I kept saying that discrete logarithm problem in the primitive subgroup is as hard as the discrete logarithm problem in FQTDN star. So I'll try to say a few words to justify that. So of course, one reduction is very easy because you have a subgroup, one of them is a subgroup of the other, therefore solving the discrete logarithm problem in the sixth, in the primitive subgroup of FQ to the N is as most as are the solving the discrete logarithm problem in FQ to the N star. And in order to do the reduction in the other way, we can consider the problem that we want to solve. Beta is alpha to the M. We know beta and alpha want to find M. So we apply an ORM map for each subfield, each proper subfield of FQ to the N, and we get more discrete logarithm problems to solve. And each of them is a discrete logarithm problem in a proper subfield. So we can solve those, and each of them tells us the value of the exponent modulo the Lth cyclotomic polynomial evaluated in Q, where L is all the divisors, all the proper divisors of N, so it corresponds to all the proper subfields. So this determines the value of M modulo this, and then the remaining information comes from solving a discrete logarithm problem in the primitive subgroup, which is should be justified by the fact that when you factor x to the n minus 1, you get the product of the cyclotomic polynomial for all the divisors of n, including n. So these are all those that were already taken care of. The last one is phi n of q, and that subgroup is that. That's the only subgroup of fq to the n of that order. So this tells you that the two problems are of equivalent difficulty. So in a sense, to study SORA is also to study the difficulty of discrete logarithm problem in finite fields of composite exponents. So we had a summer school this summer in Wyoming that was organized by Andreas Stein, and I was trying to write down some questions for students to work on, and one question that I wrote was, okay, so since we now want to study DLP in this group, the order of this group is not even, I don't know, I'm not a number theorist, so I don't know. I think it's interesting to study how much is it going to have a prime divisor, how big are the prime divisors, how much is it going to be prime as a starting question. And Jason Gower, who's sitting right there, came up with a very nice heuristic argument to count how often this group is going to have prime order. So of course, this is important if you want to study DLP in the group. And so if one uses one can use this conjecture in number theory that I didn't know before, which is called the Bateson-Horne conjecture, and essentially it predicts how often a certain set of polynomials are going to all have prime value when evaluated a certain x. So it tells us, in our specific case, it tells us that the number of primes smaller than a certain n, such that the n cyclotomic polynomial evaluated in p to the m is a prime, is O, big O of log squared of n. All my big O's look like small O's because I couldn't make them look big. But that should be a big O. Whenever you see that, that's a big O. So, and then there's a little table with some values. These are actually actual values and not the predicted values. But the predicted values are, at least for the case that he has tested, always very close to the expected. So this is a step one. This tells us how often can we expect this group to have prime order. And then the next question would be, can we study the decomposition pattern of this? So can we see how often it's going to have a big prime factor? How big a prime factor? How often, I don't know, it's going to be smooth. That would be the really bad case. But so the only method I know to attack the discrete logarithm problem in this group, which is better than either doing polar row in the group or index calculus in the big field. So in the beginning, it looked like the only two ways to attack this problem were either doing index calculus in the big field, FQ to the N star, or polar row in the subgroup. And then Granger and Falcon came up with a nice method to do index calculus in the primitive subgroup. And this method is based on on this idea of Perico 3, so I wanted to go over the idea really quick and then show how it applies. So the idea is this: you take how can we do index calculus in an abelian variety? We take an abelian variety of a certain dimension and we assume that it's represented via equations. This is just a very general setup. So each point is represented via coordinates. There will be a first set of coordinates which correspond to the dimension, sort of like a parametrization, then a few extra coordinates. And for each fixed value of x1, xd, we're going to have only a finite number of values that are possible for y1 to ye. And we can give a set of equations for the variety with this property that the first equation involves all the x and the first y, and then the second equation involves all the x, y1, and y2, etc., until the eth equation that involves all the coordinates. If you're given any random set of equations for your A, you can come up with such a set of equations. And now, this is our way to choose a factor base. So we can think of this as like we take sections by hyperplanes until we reduce to something which is one-dimensional. Or if you want, we're going to let only one of the coordinates free and fix all the other ones, for example, to zero. It doesn't really matter. And we let this one change in FQ. And remember that for each choice of this first D coordinate, there was only a finite number of values for this. So this is a one-dimensional set inside the variety, a one-dimensional abelian one-dimensional sub-variety. And we want that this generate as a group the whole thing. So we want that this is not contained in any abelian sub-variety. And so these are factor base. And with these choices, when we want to decompose a point on the factor base, we have some rational functions that I called phi 1, phi to the d plus c, which give us just, these are just the expression of the operation. And we can plug in coordinates for p1 to pn. And so we know the x and y, we know the rational function on the right-hand side, and we want to solve for the coordinates of the pi to find the decomposition of a point on the factor base. And these amount to solve in a system of equations. And it's a bit expensive, but one can do that. And then after you've collected your relation, you do, as usual, linear algebra on those. And the final result of Perico 3 is that this gives you a probabilistic algorithm that solves the DLP with a complexity of q squared to the 2 minus 2 over d, where this d is the dimension of a, up to logarithmic factors in q. And the constant in this big O, it grows very fast with d. So this is practical for small d, but our tori has very small dimension, so we hope that it will work for them, and indeed it works. So for the representation of the torus, this has only really been explicitly worked out for the representation of the torus. That is the usual one that everybody likes and always writes down, which is that one. But it works the same pretty much in all cases. Whenever you have a representation, this gives you a way to choose the factor base, and therefore it gives you a way to do index calculus. And except for the fact that the efficiency of the arithmetic is going to change, depending on which representation you use, the time that you expect, you know, to have to collect a relation of the linear algebra should not depend on that. So we write down our map that was the same as before, and now we use that to come up with a factor base. Now we take the image of here t and 0, where are, sorry, t and 0. T is a generator of fq to the m over fq. So we take the image of at and 0 here, and we get this. So we need to introduce something here. We can't just take fq as it was done in the previous case, otherwise we stay in a subvariety. So we need to twist this a little bit, but it's essentially the same idea. And then we take this AT and 0, we map it, we get this factor base. And then one can compute how long it's going to take to collect the relations and to solve the linear algebra. And this is the expected running time, where this 2 to the 12 m factor comes from the Gerbner basis computation. And the m cubed q squared comes from the linear algebra. So the predicted result in the index calculus on abelian varieties that we had before was a complexity of q to the 2 minus 1 over m. Since if we work on a torus over q to the m, the dimension is 2m. And what they get here is 2. And then they compare the figures from polar Hill, and they realize that this is at least as fast as polar Hill, and then it starts getting better as soon as m is at least 3. So if you work with a torus, with a six-dimensional torus, with a sixth torus, so with a primitive subgroup in SQ to the sixth, where Q is a prime, this doesn't give you any better than what was known already. It's always going to be better to do polar Hill. But this gives you an improvement if you work with a primitive subgroup in SQ to the 30. Because as we said, this one was contained in here. This is appearing from the, you can just write it down from the equations, because the equations of this are a subset of the equations of this, but also because from the way we parameterized it, really the parameterization that you give for this is this. So you already have this inclusion, and you have it in a very explicit manner. And now, if you do index calculus on this, you see this exponent is 5, so this is faster, this approach is faster than polar Hill. So, in conclusion, the idea between this area of source-based cryptography is that we hope that using algebraic Torah we can achieve a more compact representation of the elements in the primitive subgroup. And there's a lot of work to be done in this area, I think, both in the representation of the elements and in how efficiently the computation can be performed, and in how hard really the DLP is, because this has just started being studied. And well, this is just sort of like a subset of studying the DLP. So I think it's also nice to study the decomposition pattern of the order of these groups and the prime factors that appear. So thank you very much. Yeah.
That is still asymptotically.
Yeah. So these varieties have a certain dimension. For example, for the 30, it's dimension 8. So the best you can do, if you think of the dimension, is 8 coordinates. Because to parameterize, so that's the what I call the optimal representation, is a representation that has 8 coordinates. And now, if you add 2 more and you come up with 10 on the other side, of course, if you only want to represent one element, you're losing efficiency by it. Like, you have 2 extra coordinates that you wouldn't want in there. But if you want to represent a lot more, you can use these 2 extras, sort of iterate on the last 2. So you lose 2 in the first one, but then you reuse part of the representation of the second element to represent the third, et cetera, et cetera. And then by iterating this process, in the end, you end up with a loss that is 2 globally for a certain number of elements. So as long as you're, for example, representing 2, you're already doing better than the six dimensional case.